OYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 155 of Sign Language. A couple of weeks ago, I came across a story on IFLS. I'm assuming, I'm hoping that you know what IFLS stands for. If you don't, it's I Love Science, and I'll let you work out what the F stands for. It's a page on Facebook, which I've liked and followed for ages, and the girl who runs it, Elise Gregg, she recently, or when I say recently, probably 18 months, 2 years ago now, got offered a massive contract to produce content for Disney, and hence why they've abbreviated the name of the page to IFLS. But anyway, this was a very interesting, or I thought was an interesting story, about a new pair of headphones developed by a company in Florida called Nervana, N-E-R-V-A-N-A. And they essentially presented a prototype at this year's CES show in Las Vegas. And the product is also called Nervana. And what these headphones do is release an electrical charge that is designed to stimulate a nerve that runs through the body called the vagus nerve, which is kind of almost an in-joke that CES happens in Las Vegas, but different spelling, V-A-G-U-S. So the vagus nerve runs from the base of the brain down into your abdomen, apparently, and it releases, or it controls the neurotransmitters which release dopamine, which is sort of the happy, happy, joy, joy body drug that we, you know, experience when we eat food, when we have sex, you know, a whole bunch of different pleasurable activities. So it's kind of thought of as, well, it's the drug that is associated with reward for the body. So basically they've come up with these headphones that are supposedly going to pulsate in time with your music to stimulate the vagus nerve. Very interesting concept. I have no idea as to how good it is or whether it works or whatever, but thought it was at least worth mentioning, and I'll have two links in the show notes, one to the IFLS story, and I'll also have the link to the Nervana corporate homepage so you can go and check out their website if you want to know a little bit more about the product. I don't think it's on the market yet. They seem to have a subscribe link where you can put yourself on a mailing list so that when it is ready, they'll let you know all about it. But yeah, something a bit different. The next thing I came across, this popped up on my Facebook wall probably 4 or 5 days ago now. And it seemed to me like this thing had gone viral because it seemed like everybody was posting it for the next couple of days. But I think that's probably just a reflection of the people I'm friends with on Facebook and the, you know, the various Facebook pages that I've liked, you know, many of which are audio related, and hence the it's like that hive mentality. So everyone picked up on the same thing. This was a project that this guy built for himself, and it is a what's the best way to describe it? It is a physically powered, well, I guess all musical instruments are physically powered, but this one, he actually has to crank a handle, okay, on a flywheel. And this contraption, he calls it the Wintergaten. I think the guy is Swedish or Norwegian or something. And basically it has 2,000 marbles that, once he builds up some momentum on this crank wheel, these marbles get propelled up to the top of this machine, and then they gravity feed down through this machine. And he's built all kinds of contraptions that resonate when they get hit by these marbles. And he's factored in the time, you know, taken for all of the various elements of this machine to rotate so that, you know, he can calculate musical tempo and pauses and whatnot. It's way too complex to try and describe in an audio only format. All I will do is implore you to have a look at the link that's in the show notes. It's a YouTube video, and I'm sure this guy has been inundated with requests for interviews. It's an amazing looking gadget. I mean, far from practical. It's not even close to being practical. But when you see it, you'll just go, wow. Talk about too much time on your hands. Like, to have designed this thing and then to have actually spent the time to bring that design into the physical world and create a machine that does actually, you know, do what it's meant to do. Phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. It's about a 4.5 minute video, so it's not massive. But there is also a link in the show notes to his Bandcamp page where he's also got a photo of the machine and I think a link to the audio-only track of the machine playing its tune. It kind of makes me think of the old pianolas, except this is way more complex. And I don't think you could change the tune on this one. Although maybe it can. When you have a look at the video, you'll see that there are what appear to be racks of slots, but only one or two or whatever on any given line have a peg in them. So maybe those pegs are movable, so he can change notes and timing and pauses and all that sort of stuff. But anyway, very, very clever. Way too complex for me to contemplate doing anything like that, but I thought it was worth sharing anyway. The next thing I came across was a story from digitaltrends.com about a new audio coding algorithm, believe it or not, presented to market by none other than HTC, the mobile phone company. And this algorithm is called MQA. And although it's HTC who have sort of, you know, brought this to the world in the form of, you know, they premiered it at Mobile World Congress in Barcelona this year, its development occurred at Meridian Audio, who is a company with a very long heritage of audiophile quality hardware. I remember the name Meridian from probably the mid-90s when they were doing these really expensive, high-class compact disc players that came as two separate physical units. One unit had the drive bay and the laser, and the other unit held the DAC. And their theory behind this separated box idea was all about, you know, minimizing the potential for electronic noise, you know, to creep into the digital signal before it was decoded. And they were horrendously expensive. I think they were about $4,000 in, you know, and that's Australian dollars in mid-90s currency, you know, at a time when you could buy a CD player for a couple of $100, you know. So they were stupidly expensive. Anyway, I'm getting off the track. MQA stands for Master Quality Authenticated. Now, the guy writing this blog is Ryan Waniata, and this is from the 1st of March, and he talks about having come across this at the HTC booth and that he got to hear some of these MQA audio samples. And allegedly what is so brilliant about MQA is that they're essentially packaged like a WAV file and supposedly maintain more of that sort of three-dimensional sound that you get from an analog recording that digital just doesn't seem to manage to, you know, hang on to. You know, once we convert stuff into digital, we just seem to have a width, but we lose that perception of depth. And MQA allegedly, you know, manages to retain that depth information that, you know, certainly MP3 and, you know, all the other lossy codecs and even some of the supposedly lossless codecs just don't seem to hang on to. What I did find disappointing with the article was that he doesn't mention what he was monitoring on. You know, was it earbuds? Was it headphones? Did they take him out and, you know, put him in a quiet room where there was a set of loudspeakers? how quiet was the environment in which he was listening to this stuff. You know, none of that stuff is addressed, unfortunately. He just raves about the quality of these MQA files. The other interesting point about these MQA files is that they are supposedly about three times smaller, or sorry, I should have said one third the size of a comparable FLAC file. Now, FLAC is usually about half the size of the original WAV file. So if it's one third of that, it's basically a 6-to-1 improvement over a full res WAV file, if, you know, if all the other hype is to be believed. So that's pretty good, because that's even smaller than a 320 kilobit MP3, which is about a 4-to-1 compression ratio from the original WAV file. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see. At the moment, this technology is built into HTC's A9 phone as a proof of concept. And I'm assuming that that phone was released this year, and that, you know, obviously if the format takes off, they will incorporate it into more phones, and then, you know, presumably they will license the technology to other vendors if anyone's interested in it. Of course, you know, all of that depends on whether or not consumers give a toss, because at the end of the day, that's, you know, that's the main thing. If consumers don't care, then yeah, it's dead in the water. And let's face it, we've got a generation of millennials growing up who are happy with 128 kilobit MP3s played through crappy Apple earbuds. So who knows? We will wait and see. Okay, it wouldn't be an episode of Sign Language if we didn't hear from Rob. And Rob wrote to me probably a month, 6 weeks ago now, and I did promise that I would cover this one in the last episode of Sign Language. And this was called Forgotten Voice Font Ghosts. And this was quite a long email, so I might post the text on the show notes for anyone that wants to read it all. I'm just going to cover some bits and pieces. Rob started out, "I listen to a lot of podcasts, or rather I try them out. My tests boil down to three questions. Is it interesting? Does the host have what it takes to keep the show going? Does it sound consistently decent?" So then Rob went on to talk about, you know, consistency of content delivery and all that sort of stuff. And then he started to talk about what he calls sub-vocalization, that idea of, you know, when you are reading something off the page, you're imagining a particular voice reading it. And most of the time, that's your own voice if you're not reading out loud. And then he went on to talk about James Earl Jones and, you know, him reading the Bible, but also being the voice of Darth Vader and so on. And then we get to, which brings me to the next very interesting subject. People with majestic voices and amazing reading skills like James Earl Jones have always existed throughout history, but we're only lucky enough to be able to preserve their talent in recorded audio. Just imagine the people that read better than him, or had even more powerful voices but lived before recording audio was possible. Here's the other sad part. James Earl Jones is currently 85 years old and may soon leave us. Granted, none of us knows how much time we have left, but given his advanced age, the legend may very likely leave us first. This causes a problem because James Earl Jones' voice work is truly timeless and larger than life. But the reality is that Darth Vader is insignificant because Master Jones recorded far more powerful material acting-wise. Sadly, when he dies, his amazing talent will forever be gone. Or will it? What if I told you James Earl Jones' voice may come back from the dead, Bruce? How about other talented voices that were thought to be forever lost? Welcome to the unholy land of voice fonts through speech synthesis. Back in 2005, Susan Bennett, the woman behind iPhone's virtual assistant Siri, spent 4 hours a day for the whole month of July recording sounds and sentences to build the sound banks needed to eventually build Siri. This is remarkable because it took several years for them to use those recordings from the past to build something that currently mimics speech.
See where this is going? Legends like James Earl Jones have recorded far more than just 16 hours of audio that could eventually be used to build a Franken-voice voice font puppet that would only require a similar-sounding voice actor to work as a voice puppeteer. Let's not forget, Siri's far more complex than just a voice font provided by actors. If we strip away the voice recognition, the AI, and all the extras, all we have is sound banks that convincingly mimic human speech from text. Let's say it's the year 2020. The legend has passed away, and we want to build a James Earl Jones Franken voice font simply because Walt Disney's paying big money and they want to make a new trilogy of Darth Vader's dark and evil lost years. Since money would be an incentive, in my opinion, there are three main problems that would have to be solved in order for the Franken voice font to take place, which are the following. Wealth of the legally available sound bank, emotional intonation blending, voice puppeteer match. The first hurdle would be the redundancy and richness of sounds available. The higher the number of quality voice recordings, the richer the resulting sound banks will be. Also, it would be vital to clear the rights with James Earl Jones' family. They would have to be assured the result would edify and never tarnish the memory of their late family member. Let's say they sign away the rights because the millions and millions of dollars made sense. The second problem would be emotional intonation blending, or in other words, finding sounds that, put together, could express anger, sorrow, worry, regret, and all of the other emotions that things like Siri currently do not have. The solution I would propose would be finding similar phonemes from majestic performances such as James Earl Jones' Shakespeare in the Park, King Lear, which provide great emotional range but poor audio quality. I chose Darth Vader as a case study because the voice pitch changes, the phasing and the compression needed for Darth Vader's voice could ostensibly hide the poor quality of some of the samples from King Lear's live performance. The last hurdle would be to find a range of affordable voice puppeteer actors that could imitate Darth Vader well enough, then read the lines so that we could merge the result with emotional intonation sound banks from performances like King Lear. The reason for the multiple actors is simple. All of them would be disposable, and there would be less drama like the one with the voice cast from The Simpsons or when they switched from Mark Hamill to the cheaper Troy Baker for the Joker's voice. Let's imagine that by the year 2025, the software is so advanced that it even uses a virtualized larynx, and all you have to do is feed it voice recordings, and at the end of 1 week, it's finished assembling the voice font, and now all you have to do is speak into it, and it outputs the almost perfect emulated voice. What if I told you it could get worse? Let me ask you this question. Do you know anybody that records lots of high-quality audio but is not very careful with copyrights? Exactly. Podcasters may eventually become public domain raw material to make voice fonts from. What if 100 years into the future Tim Curry's voice became public domain and was used to read mini eulas and it was as annoying as it is today in order for people to just accept the contracts and avoid the torture of listening to his voice? Nothing would be more painful than a long legal document read in Tim Curry's voice. How about Leo Laporte's voice used for leases and contracts if they still exist in the future? I cannot think of a better deterrent for listening. How about my voice? Or your voice? What if in 100 years, someone decided to use our voices to produce voice fonts for nefarious purposes like reading super corny ethnic restaurant menu items? I'd read the taco menu. Also, I, for one, think that kangaroo hamburgers are the future of fast food, especially if read in copyright-free Bruce Williams voice font. Think of shrimp on the barbie, but worse, roo burgers on the barbie. What about your voice in other languages? It would only be a matter of getting the right phonemes to force Bruce to speak in Mandarin to sell the roo burgers all over China. Don't believe me? Consider the fact that there are already voice changers that allow you to primitively change your voice to male or female or even that of a child.
Check out the link in the show notes for the video on that one.
Also, there are telemarketing companies that use almost perfect sound banks to call people in the US and avoid the accent problem and deceive people. Where it all falls apart is where the AI or the person using the soundboard cannot say the phrase, "I am not a robot," thus giving the travesty away, like in this video.
And there'll be another link in the show notes.
But more seriously, there are many, many actors and podcasts that will likely become public domain because nobody lives forever and very few people and families are careful enough with the rights to their online footprint. It would stand to reason that in the future, lawsuits will become either more expensive, more frivolous, or just cheaper and as frivolous because people might say, "Who cares about the voices in just 3 terabytes of orphaned vintage podcasts? My 5-year-old produces more data in a single afternoon." Oh man, what if lynda.com ends up being sold and they end up owning all the rights to your voice and they start churning out the most mundane knitting tutorials with your voice font? How about you? Will your voice become public domain in the next 100 years? Man, the future is scary and or fascinating.
Interesting thoughts, Rob. Thank you once again. A few things to add to that. On the subject of Siri, I will have something to add to that conversation in about 12 or 18 months' time. Can't say any more right now. Microphone variations was just a note that I took. And basically what I'm thinking of here is, you know, all the performances that you are referring to. You know, you take a James Earl Jones, for example, right? Yes, there may be a wealth of his voice samples around, but they will have all been recorded in different quality, you know, depending on, you know, the mic that was used, the preamp that was used, whether it was compressed and EQ'd at the time of recording, the quality of the room that he was in, how far he was from the microphone, because let's take it, you know, live theatre, they're, you know, miles from any microphone. All of that stuff, I would imagine, is going to have a detrimental impact on the ability to build a sound font out of multiple performances. I would imagine that for this to work convincingly, you really would need the Siri type approach where you sit the voice artists down for an extended period of time in a studio and get them to record everything that is required so that you've got, you know, all of those phonemes in, you know, all the different emotions and pacing and all that kind of stuff, but from a consistent, you know, sound point of view, you know, same mic, same desk, same everything, right? I didn't quite understand what you meant by the puppeteer thing. You've obviously done a little bit more research on this, Rob, than I have had an opportunity to do. It sounds like what you're describing is almost like vocoding, where you have a carrier and a modulator, where, you know, one signal is, you know, the input voice. So that could be any, you know, voice artist. That would be the carrier signal. The modulation in this context would be James Earl Jones. And the idea is that the thumbprint, if you like, of James Earl Jones' voice in a waveform sense is mapped onto the input signal, you know, coming from another voice, and they're sort of vocoded. That's kind of my understanding of where you're going with the whole voice puppeteer thing, but if I've misunderstood, please let me know. Love to hear more if you've got any other ideas on how that is implemented, how that works. As for my voice, mate, I don't think there's much chance of anyone ripping off my voice. There are far better voice talents around than me. But it's interesting. It's certainly an interesting concept. I'd have to say, you know, one of my favorite voices that I've ever had the pleasure of working with, you know, in my radio career, was a guy by the name of Ray McGregor. And some of my listeners may know Ray's name. Ray, I think he was English originally. I know that in the 70s, he was working on one or two of the pirate radio stations in the North Atlantic. And I remember this, I met Ray, late 80s, I guess, in Brisbane. And, you know, after we had been introduced and we got talking, and he was talking about, you know, pirate radio in the North Atlantic, and he was telling me this story about how this little pirate radio station was situated in one of these old, like, oil rig type structures, you know, these sort of four concrete pillars standing up out of the ocean, but very small ones. And he said, you would go out there, he said, and you'd be out there for, you know, a couple of weeks at a time, and you were by yourself. And he said, your basic premise was to broadcast for as many hours of the day as you possibly could. And, yeah, you played whatever it was that you wanted to play. And he said, above the console in the on-air studio, there were three lights, a green light, an orange light, and a red light. He said, if the green light was on, which it was most of the time, it meant it's really rough outside, but you're okay. Because it's the North Atlantic, it's never still. If the orange light came on, it meant it is super duper rough outside. We don't think the rig's going to stay upright. We're sending someone out to get you, have your bags packed and be ready to go. If the red light came on, it basically meant we're not coming to get you. The rig's definitely going over. Pack your bags, throw the life, you know, the the inflatable dinghy thingamajiggy out, and you're on your own. Which I don't know whether he was pulling my leg or whether it really was that bad, but yeah, it always gave me a chuckle whenever I thought about that story. But Ray McGregor had an absolutely beautiful voice. I've heard a lot of really amazing voiceover guys, you know, guys with big, deep, ballsy voices, and you know, guys that have really great, just all different types of great voices, you know. And I can think of a whole bunch off the top of my head, you know, certainly guys within the Australian voiceover scene. But Ray just had this amazing low end to his voice that was just like rolling thunder, but his whole voice was not like that. He also had this nice mid-range cut through. There are some guys I've tried to, you know, record and work with before, and they've got that really good low rumble, but sometimes it can be really hard to get them to cut through in a mix. Ray just had this beautifully balanced voice. I'll dig out an old promo that I've got some stuff from my early days as a production guy, which I, you know, these days I would cringe to listen to, but I'll dig something out and put a link to it in the show notes so you can hear what Ray's voice sounded like. I still, to this day, think of all the voiceovers I've heard in my, you know, currently 28 and a half years in this industry, I think his was the voice I missed the most. He's dead now. Very, very sad, but yeah. Sorry, I got sidetracked there, Rob, but I don't think anyone's going to worry about my voice. I really don't think anyone's going to, you know, steal my voice to turn it into a sound font. If they do, they're welcome to it. I don't think anyone's going to be missing out on any royalties of my voice somehow. So anyway, mate, love to hear more about the puppeteer thing. And if you've anything else you want to add to that, that'd be great. Right, I think that will do it for this episode. Any questions, comments, feedback, please drop me an email, studio@audiotu.com. And until I speak with you next, take care.
Sign language.
Another audiotu.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com.
Or search the iTunes Music Store for questions, comments, and feedback. Email studio@audiotu.com.